Adventure's Westerners had visited Tibet for many years and returned with exotic tales of miracles and mystery. Details of Tibetan Buddhist practice were sketchy. The publication of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, an important Buddhist text, caused quite a stir in 1927. But still, very little was known of Tibetan Buddhism outside of Tibet until teachers and lamas began coming to the West in the 1960s and 70s, escaping the brutal invasion of their country by the communist Chinese. Sogyal Rinpoche is a Tibetan Lama who now teaches in the U.S. and Europe and other parts of the world.
One very famous prophecy is the prophecy about the when the horse has gone wheels and when the iron birds start flying, my people shall scatter all over the world, my teaching shall come to the land of the red face. There is that prophecy, and it's very rightly so. I remember when I came in 1976 with Dujum Rinpoche, many of the Buddhist scholars and people who are really studying the movement of spirituality in the West, you know, they were saying, remarking that it's quite extraordinary that the Chinese came and took over Tibet, and Tibetans have to run away at a particular time. It's more than a coincidence. At a particular time when the West was also going through a spiritual kind of a revolution in some sense.
The coming of Tibetan Buddhism to this country, from Buddhist point of view, is an interesting karmic occurrence. That when the Chinese came into Tibet in 1959, or rather when many of the Tibetan teachers left Tibet in 1959, all of a sudden this huge wealth of Tibetan Buddhist scholarship and meditative teachings became available not only to the United States but to the world at large.
Buddhist historian Rick Fields.
This was unprecedented in Tibetan history, certainly, and in Western history, because before that, Tibet had been very isolated from the rest of the world, and even including Asia, and very difficult to get to. So the Tibetans had actually been able to preserve and to develop forms of Buddhism that had been destroyed in India, nearly 1,000 years before, forms of Buddhism that hadn't, you know, that had been very weakened in China itself as well, and they had a real tradition of scholarship going back to the tradition of Indian Buddhist scholarship, also that was kept alive in the Tibetan monasteries.
My old friend Lodi Gary from the International Campaign for Tibet in Washington is His Holiness the Dalai Lama's special envoy to the United Nations.
We are a nation of only 6 million inhabitants. It's a big physically, but in terms of population, very small country. And 1.2 million of our people died as a result of Chinese occupation. Now that is almost, one-fifth of the entire population of Tibet. More than 6,000 of our monasteries were destroyed, completely destroyed. Now, those monasteries were not just monasteries where monks did meditation or conducted their services, but there were also like colleges, universities, schools, libraries. I think one of the positive aspects of the unfortunate thing that had happened to Tibet was the spread of Tibetan Buddhism throughout the world, not only to the United States.
The first Tibetan Buddhist temple in the United States opened in New Jersey in 1952. It was set up to minister to a group of Mongolian refugees brought to the U.S. after World War II by the Tolstoy Foundation. In 1955, a Tibetan Lama named Geshe Wangyal arrived in New Jersey. After obtaining a charter from the Dalai Lama, he opened the first Buddhist monastery open to Americans. Among his first students was Robert Thurman, a Harvard student who had just returned from Asia. Thurman became the first American Tibetan Buddhist monk. He now teaches at Columbia University and is the co-founder of the American Institute of Buddhist Studies, an organization devoted to bridging academia and Buddhist teachings. Thurman Herman was part of an adventurous trickle of young, curious Americans that soon became a deluge. Seeking gurus, grass, and good times, they made overland pilgrimages to ashrams, monasteries, and sacred sites all over Asia. The intricate, colorful style of Tibetan art and its phantasmagorical pantheon of archetypal demons and deities struck a familiar psychedelic chord with some of these travelers. Those who survived the trip returned home with a new consciousness that would help pave the way for the spiritual teachers to follow. As Tibetan lamas sharpened their English in exile in India and Europe, some inevitably found their way to the United States. Darteng Tulku arrived in Berkeley in 1969. He could hardly have landed on more fertile ground. Within a short time, he had founded the Tibetan Nyingma Meditation Center, the first Vajrayana congregation in America. One of the main activities of the Nyingma community is the collection, preservation, and reproduction of the hundreds and hundreds of volumes of Tibetan Buddhist texts.
Historically, in Tibet, different monasteries had collections, but never before has all of these texts been brought together in one collection, even in Tibet. The 600 and more Western volumes, and more are planned, more are coming, represent all of the Nyingma lineages, and in addition to that, the most important texts from the other lineages, the arts and sciences, poetry, literature, astrology, medicine, grammar, incredible collection, a whole library. And then the goal, the long-range goal, is of course then to put these texts back into the Tibetan monasteries, which were so badly devastated in this last couple of generations. The monasteries are gone, the libraries are gone, and even the monastic lineages are gone.
Tartang Tulku was followed a year later by Lama Chogyam Trungpa, who had spent several years at Oxford after escaping from Tibet. Trungpa became one of the most popular and charismatic teachers of Buddhism Americans had ever encountered. He founded many urban meditation centers called Dharmadhatus all over the United States and Europe. In 1974, he founded the Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, a kind of Buddhist university that offered a heady mixture of courses in meditation, art, languages, poetry, and philosophy. 2,000 people attended the first summer session. From the beginning, the Institute attracted a stellar faculty. Allen Ginsberg is the founder of the Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa Institute.
The whole point of Buddhist art is the awareness of your own mind, wakefulness, and a spontaneous action based on clear awareness and clear seeing. I think that the Buddhist inspiration has inspired a renaissance in painting and poetry and other arts in America, and it's been a tremendous influence, but it's an old American tradition from the era of the Transcendentalists who were studying Hermetic texts from Europe as well as Vedas and Buddhist texts way back in the 19th century. And it's expanded and enriched and become more common, but it certainly is part of the old American tradition, going back to the Brook Farm folk and some of the deists, Thomas Paine, Jefferson, and others who had an appreciation of the non-hierarchical possibilities of religious open-mindedness.
If you want to learn how to meditate, I'll tell you now, cause it's never too late. I'll tell you how, cause I can't wait. It's just that great that it's never too late. If you are an old fraud like me, or a lama who lives in eternity, the first thing you do when you meditate is keep your spine, your backbone straight. Sit yourself down on a pillow on the ground, or sit in a chair if the ground isn't there. If the ground isn't there, if the ground isn't there.
San Francisco was a crucible for American Buddhism in the 1950s. Perhaps nowhere in America was the meeting of East and West so dynamic, nurtured, and productive.
Our intentions were a kind of spiritual liberation from the beginning. And then as time went on, Buddhism seemed to be the most appropriate formulation. I'd had some what you might call mystical or visionary experiences relating to William Blake in 1948, and it wasn't until I ran into Suzuki's writings and the Buddhist terminology of Satori and whatnot that I began finding a language to express the experiences I had that wasn't stuck with a monotheistic reference. 50s. I think Kerouac was out here, and a friend of his, Neil Cassidy, was interested in some kind of a Native American spiritualism. The guy from Virginia Beach, Edgar Casey, and his ideas of reincarnation and all karma. So Kerouac was a little put off by this kind of crude American version, so he went back to read Buddhist texts, Surangama Sutra, Lankavatara Sutra, Diamond Sutra, Prajnaparamita, Milarepa, in Dwight Goddard's anthology, A Buddhist Bible. And that turned him on completely, and he kept notes on it and on his readings and writings, and began writing poetry of that, with that, those ideas of transitoriness, suffering, and anatma, emptiness, an empty soul in his mind, in his texts, including a monumental work called Mexico City Blues, which had a tremendous effect on Bob Dylan years later, blowing Dylan's mind and turning him into a poet. So Kerouac introduced me to the basic concepts, including the notion that existence contains suffering, which hadn't occurred to me before, like a nice Jewish boy believing in progress.
Through artistic expression, intellectual dialogue, cross-fertilization, and synthesis, American Buddhists continued to explore new realms of experience and means of practice. Jack Kornfeld and Joseph Goldstein met at the Naropa Institute in the 1970s. Both had studied Theravadan Buddhism in Asia and returned to the U.S. to teach. Theravada is a broad category of Buddhism. It's often referred to as a southern branch or way of the elders. Kornfeld and Goldstein joined forces and began teaching a form of insight meditation called Vipassana. The pair set up a meditation center in Vermont in 1976, run in a cooperative manner around a core of teachers rather than one master. Jack Kornfeld spent many years in a forest monastery in Thailand. Here he tells of his return to America.
The tradition of insight meditation, which is called Vipassana, that I am a teacher for, is one of the most American forms of Buddhism to develop yet. It was brought to this country by myself and a group of others who were trained in India, Thailand, and Burma in monasteries for many years. We came as Americans back and started a variety of retreat centers and offered teachings without the usual rituals, robes, bells, and chanting that one finds in the temples of the East. Instead, we offered the simple practices of meditation, of generosity, of compassion, the ways of right livelihood and virtue in the world that transform one's being and one's heart.
The relative absence of religious trappings and dogmatic leadership makes Vipassana attractive to many Americans. In contrast, in the early days of Tibetan Buddhism in the U.S., many students had trouble adjusting to the strong role of the teacher or guru. There is no cultural model for such a relationship in the West, but Tibetan teachers have managed to overcome much of their students' initial reluctance. At the same time that the Tibetans were making inroads into American Buddhism, the Buddhist tradition of the Chinese, which was actually the first to arrive on American soil, began to attract American students. In San Francisco, Master Xuan Hua began teaching all five Chinese Buddhist traditions. In 1976, Master Hua founded the city of 10,000 Buddhas on 237 acres in Northern California. The city has austere monk cells for several hundred people, and a non-sectarian university that combines a Buddhist atmosphere with secular and spiritual education.
Our teacher came here in the 1960s and really didn't begin to have a lot of following until about 1968, when a group of Americans came to do a summer session. And at that time it was located in Chinatown in San Francisco. And over the next few years, five of those Americans became the first Americans to be ordained in the tradition, the Chinese tradition. And this, unlike some of the ordinations, it is considered a commitment for life. It's not something you just do for a little while, though of course some people change their minds. Things grew slowly, first in San Francisco, then a temple was established in Los Angeles, and then we bought the city of 10,000 Buddhas.
Mm-hmm. Buddhism was brought to Korea from China in the 4th century. The Chinese Chan tradition, which became Zen when it moved to Japan, became San in Korea. The most well-known Korean Buddhist teacher in America is Sun San. He founded the Providence Zen Center in Rhode Island in the 1970s. Professor Robert Moore is one of his disciples.
One of the major differences between the Japanese Zen tradition and the Korean Zen tradition is that the Zen teachers in Korea do not isolate themselves from the larger Korean Buddhist community. And the Zen teachers are at the same temples where you have precepts monks and where you have sutra scholarly monks and where you have ritual monks, the people who perform, you know, ceremonies and all of that. So they're all in the same temple. So typically what happens is that there will be a small cadre of monks who are interested in Zen and they'll do the Zen meditation, but the larger number of monks are involved in other kinds of activities. So given that that's the case, when De Sansanim, Zen Master Sung San, came to Los Angeles, then he took over as almost like what you would call the pastor of this large Korean community. And the Zen Center, the American Zen Center, actually was located in a building on that grounds for a long time. And we moved to our own independent location, which is a few blocks down the street, in the mid-80s. So there still remains a very close relationship between the Korean temple and the monks that are in residence there, and then the Zen Center.
Buddhist practice varies greatly from tradition to tradition. Though its original form rejected the idea of a creator being, some denominations over time have become highly devotional in nature. One such group is Soka Gakkai, the lay organization of the Japanese Nichiren Shoshu Buddhist sect. Larry Florin is head of the Soka Gakkai Youth Division.
This Buddhism is based upon the teachings of Nichiren Daishonin. He was a priest that lived in the 1200s, and he had rejected the Buddhism at the time that he was taught, and he through many teachings and was able to come upon the Lotus Sutra as the highest teaching. And the basic practice, we break it into something called faith practice and study. And what we do is we chant Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, which is the title, the Lotus Sutra.
Soka Gakkai has been controversial since its founding in 1930. It has politically conservative and highly nationalistic underpinnings. And unlike other Buddhist traditions, its members proselytize. In the 1960s and 70s, when it came to the West, members were aggressively recruited on the street. In 1991, the high priest of Nichiren Buddhism in Japan excommunicated the 12 million member Soka Gakkai. With 12 million adherents worldwide, Soka Gakkai is one of the fastest growing religions. Unlike other Buddhist traditions, Soka Gakkai encourages its followers to chant for specific rewards, like jobs, money, fulfillment of personal desires. Soka Gakkai was initially brought to the U.S. to serve the needs of Japanese war brides. Once again, the winds of war propelled Buddhism from one country to another. And so also with the Vietnamese War, which drove millions of Vietnamese Buddhists out of the country. One of them was Minh Duc.
The Buddhist Church stood up against both sides and said, well, no, nobody's going to win if you kill each other. So that was the problem. That was why, that how the Buddhist was accused by both sides. But the American side, they thought the Buddhist Church was communist. And the communist would think the Buddhist Church would be the agent of the U.S. Government.
One of the most powerful and disturbing images of the war in Southeast Asia, and one of the most misunderstood by non-Buddhists in America, was the self-immolation of Buddhist monks protesting the war.
For some Americans, they considered his death like a suicide. No, it's not suicidal. When people are talking about killing themselves, they are frustrated, depressed. They don't know how to deal with the problems. They are trying to run away from the problems. The Venerable Thich Quang Duc was at that time 60s, the late 60s. He was healthy, perfectly mental alert. And at that time, the government did the kind of bad things to the Buddhist Church. We were not allowed to preach. We were not allowed to to have a lecture. We have not allowed to do a lot of things. So the government pushed us into the corner. We couldn't fight against violently. So Thich Quang Đức decided to, well, he asked the permission of the Mahasangha, of the congregation. And what he wrote and what he publicly told us was, he wants himself to be a torch, like a light, to light up the conscience of the government. Because we believe that because of the hatred, because of ignorance, the government at that time didn't treat us okay. I mean, treated us badly. We didn't blame the government. We didn't blame the president. But we blame the ignorance, the lack of understanding. He sat there, still. He sat still until his last breath. But 20 minutes after he started, he lighted up. So he was perfectly in control.
During and after the Vietnamese War, monks followed refugee communities to provide spiritual support and counseling. Dr. Thien An, a Zen monk and scholar, came to the U.S. in 1966 to teach Americans. But when the Vietnamese refugees began arriving in California, he quickly split his attentions to minister to their needs.
Bong bong, tôi là chuông đại hồng.
The Vietnamese teacher, who has made the greatest impact on the American conscience and sensibility, however, is a soft-spoken man, Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh. Thich Nhat Hanh has achieved international respect and recognition for his work in healing the wounds of the Vietnam War. He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. He's worked with both Vietnamese refugees and American Vietnam vets like Jim Janko.
I became attracted to Buddhism, especially a Buddhism that has social engagement as an integral part of the teachings in the community. And Thich Nhat Hanh and the community around him, at the Community of Mindful Living in Berkeley, and the other communities that support his work, I'm very much attracted to their sincere efforts to work for peace, for environmental issues, for economic justice, and to see Buddhism as a vehicle not only for changing oneself but for making the world a better place. You know, it does seem strange, a Vietnam vet having a Vietnamese monk as a teacher, but it seems totally natural to me at the same time. Totally natural and appropriate. I think it's really important to be accepted by people, Vietnamese people, who also experienced the destruction of the war, who know as well as anybody what the American military did in Vietnam. And for those people to accept you is it's a very heart-opening experience. Sometimes it is difficult to take. To be so openly accepted and to have them just hold out their hands to you is extremely powerful and very healing.
Here in America, we have one of the greatest events in Buddhist history, where you have in one land, one country, Laotian, Thai, Tibetan, Japanese, Korean, whole vast number of Buddhist sects from different countries, with different practices, different objectives, and who had traditionally been enemies of each other, who have come here and learned how to coexist together. And more often than not, in what we might call Western Buddhism, there's an integration of these different schools. We find that Vipassana practitioners may also read some things from Zen masters, and we find that some people who practice Zen might also do some Tantra or some Tibetan type of practices and so on. So we're finding a whole bunch of different factors that allow for this type of integration. And in some sense, really a unique moment in the history of the Dharma, and quite wonderful to see too, as a vast tapestry in which various elements overlap.
All branches of Buddhism now sprout from the American Buddhist tree, a tree whose roots thrust deeper into the earth with the passing of every spring. It is growing and blossoming and has begun to bear the fruit of wisdom and compassion. Well, we've come to the end of this now. This is Richard Gere wishing you all supreme happiness and the causes of future happiness. Walk on.
Eats Meets West was produced by Pamela Michael and Sue Supriano and written by Pamela Michael. Interviews were by Sue Supriano. Our engineer was Matt Binder. The production was funded in part by the California Council for the Humanities, the Tides Foundation, the Numata Center for Buddhist Translation and Research, Buddhist Churches of America, Richard Gere, Stephen Rockefeller, Virginia Warner, Pamela Krasny, and Brian Gibson. Special thanks to the Institute of Buddhist Studies, KPFA Radio, David Gans, and especially to Richard Gere for his narration and support. For information about this program, write to the Buddhist Radio Project, 1602 Delaware Street, Berkeley, California, 94703.